From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Jeremy Hobson is off today.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump unleashed a tweet storm this morning, saying the fake news media hates when I use my powerful social media, and calling the investigation into him a witch hunt.
But in a video last message played at the congressional baseball game last night, President Trump talked about unity.
In Washington, we have our disagreements, but we all agree that we are here to serve this nation we love and the people who call it home. That's the source of unity. And more than ever, we must embrace it so that on this special night, I leave you with three great American words that for generations have torn down barriers, built bridges of unity, and defied those who have sought to pull us apart. Ladies and gentlemen, let's play ball.
Well, let's do that. Let's get to our political roundtable. Joining us, Abby Phillip, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Abby, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And Jeff Bennett, NPR congressional reporter. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Jeff, I want to start with you because we spoke a lot this week as you reported on the shooting at the Republican baseball practice last night at the game. Mm-hmm. We saw Paul Ryan and Nancy Pelosi, you know, sitting together, their first interview together. I remember when I lived in Washington in the 90s, going to a private event and seeing Newt Gingrich and Ted Kennedy backslapping, you know, having this friendly time. This is when the rhetoric was really vitriolic. And I was stunned and even a little angry, you know, to see that they were so friendly when we didn't see that, you know, that wasn't the public face we saw. Do you think that this shooting this week is maybe going to change the tone in Washington? Maybe we're going to see more party leaders together rather than at each other's throats?
Perhaps. But the underlying issue here, Robin, is that on the actual policies, the two parties are so far apart. You think of health care. You think of tax reform. There really is no tax bill yet. But infrastructure, things like that. On the issues, there really is not that much agreement. I do think, though, that one of the things we've heard from congressional leaders, even rank and file members, frankly, is that this really was an inflection point for Congress, and members are thinking more about how they speak to each other and about each other.
Well, Abby, I want to get your opinion on that because Republican Congressman Chris Collins of New York has expressed regret. He initially, right after the shooting, said it was Democratic rhetoric about President Trump that inspired the shooting. He's since taken that back, said he was sorry. Arch-conservative Ted Nugent said he feels responsible because some of his language is so vitriolic. He called President Obama a subhuman mongrel in the past. So he's reexamining, doing some soul-searching. But former House Speaker Newt Gingrich says a cultural civil war is brewing.
Well, I think that those examples really perfectly illustrate probably the main reason why, even though when some people might rethink their rhetoric here, the overall trend, I don't see it really changing a whole lot. There are very loud voices, and I would argue the President of the United States is among them, who continues to use rhetoric in the political sphere that has escalated conflicts of all different varieties. And I think that, you know, as long as that remains the case, it's going to be very hard for this moment in Washington, which I do think is very real right now, but it is going to be hard for that to last much longer than where we are right now, than 48 hours after a really horrific shooting. Perhaps by next week, when we're back to talking about the healthcare bill and other, the Russia investigation and other things, we will be back in much of the same place where we've been up until this point.
And it is a measure of America that we should also note that there was that shooting in San Francisco as well, where multiple people died. But I want to play a little bit of tape here. This is the president in a more conciliatory tone, speaking from the White House yesterday. He's talking about injured Congressman Steve Scalise.
And Steve, in his own way, may have brought some unity to our long divided country. We've had a very, very divided country for many years. And I have a feeling that Steve has made a great sacrifice, but there could be some unity being brought to our country. Let's hope so.
But then there are the tweets that we, you know, some of which we've already mentioned. Yesterday, he accused the media of making up stories to, quote, meet their agenda of hate. I mean, Jeff, Abby sort of reflected on this already, but same question to you. Like, what's the role of the president here? What could be the role of President Trump in this moment?
Well, he could use the office of the presidency to do something big, right? To turn the page and make make it work for him without having to use these tweets using labels like witch hunt and other things like that. I mean, any student of history would know that that label is misapplied. Anyone who knows anything about McCarthyism would know that what's happening to him is not a witch hunt. And I think in some ways it's understandable that if the president was told privately by the former FBI director that he was not subject to investigation, he would want that to be publicly known. But in either not knowing about the boundaries that exist or not caring about those boundaries and in trying to clear up that fact that he wasn't under investigation, he in effect landed himself under investigation. And so what you hear from Republicans on the Hill is that they just want him to be quiet and just, you know, follow the advice we assume he's getting from his lawyers and from his press shop.
Well, good luck with that. And let's talk about the Russia investigation, which was leaking like a sieve this week. We heard, yes, the news that the president himself was being investigated, not for the collusion with the Russians, but for obstruction of justice. And then news that his son-in-law and top advisor Jared Kushner's business dealings were being investigated. But before that, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein testified this week, and he was questioned here by Oklahoma Senator James Lankford about speculation raised by Trump associates that Robert Mueller, the special counsel that Rosenstein hired to take over the FBI Russia investigation when James Comey was fired, that Mueller himself might be fired. Let's listen.
Is there anything to some secret plan that's out there from you or anyone in the administration to try to go and remove the special counsel?
There is no secret plan that involves me, no, Senator.
So, Abby, I want you to take up the next event that happened, and you need a whiteboard for this. But there was this remarkable statement last night in which Rosenstein warned Americans to be skeptical about media reports citing anonymous officials. And this came just a few hours after the Washington Post reported that Special Counsel Mueller is investigating the business dealings of Jared Kushner. What do you make of that from Rosenstein?
Well, to add to the confusion, I will say that it's still a little bit unclear what Rosenstein's statement was even referring to, whether it was the Washington Post stories, which we clarified very shortly after, that were based on U.S. officials, or some other story that is forthcoming that maybe cites foreign officials, as he implied in his statement. You know, the trouble here is that you have the president kind of sticking his hand into a fairly sensitive legal matter. And in some cases, he may be forcing other things to happen. So, for example, by basically blaming Rosenstein for Comey's firing, he's putting Rosenstein even more into the mix if there is such an obstruction of justice investigation underway into whether the firing of James Comey was an attempt by President Trump to squash an investigation. So there is a lot going on here. And I think one of the big things is that this president keeps discussing this conversation, this investigation, and the White House and his lawyers really don't have much to say to clarify some of these comments, some of which are not entirely accurate.
Yeah. Well, let's talk for a little bit about what Attorney General Jeff Sessions said when he publicly testified about the investigation. Here's an exchange that Sessions had with Oregon Democrat Senator Ron Wyden about the fact that the Attorney General has recused himself from the Russia investigation.
Respectfully, you're not answering the
question. Well, what is the question?
The question is, Mr. Comey said that there were matters with respect to the recusal that were problematic and he couldn't talk about them. What are they?
Why don't you tell me? They are none, Senator Wyden. There are none.
Jeff, let me ask you. I mean, there was also all the exchanges about whether or not Sessions was invoking executive privilege. He said he wasn't,
right.
But then there was Justice Department, some sort of guidance that he talked about. I mean, what did you make about all that?
Well, you know, the Democrats on that committee certainly were not pleased with what Attorney General Sessions did not say. There are all sorts of questions about his meetings with the Russian ambassador, about his proper recusal. I think Sessions tried to emerge from that session without having saying anything that would come back to haunt him, you know, in 30-second sound bites on cable TV. And I think that's what he was trying to get at, and that was his end goal.
Well, you know, you guys, we only got about a minute left here. You know what bugs me? This is what week is this that we're still talking about the Russia investigation, and we have not mentioned that President Trump authorized his defense secretary to set troop levels in Afghanistan, or there is secret negotiations on the health care bill that's
in the Senate, kind of
ruffling feathers of both Republicans and Democrats, or that President Trump is rolling back some of the Obama era loosening of restrictions on travel to Cuba. I mean, just comment on that, Abby. Nothing else getting talked about.
Yeah, and beyond that, the federal agencies are actively working to roll back civil rights offices across the federal government. There has been some activity on immigration in the last week. There's a lot going on, some of which is very important that we are not talking about. And frankly, the White House wants everyone to actually be talking about the things that they're doing, but Trump is the one who refuses to do that.
Let's pledge to do it next time. Abby Phillip, White House reporter for The Washington Post. Jeff Bennett, NPR congressional reporter. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sunday is Father's Day, and this Father's Day will take on new significance for a North Carolina man and his family. He recently found out that he has two biological children who've been searching for him. The life-altering news comes as the 47-year-old battles a lethal form of cancer. He's a longtime friend of Lynn Joliker from Here Now contributor WBUR, and she brings us his story.
When my friend Sean Bunn found out early this year that he has two grown biological daughters, his immediate thought was, maybe this is why I'm still alive.
This feels to me like an absolute wonderful gift.
You see, Sean has been sick, very sick. Doctors initially thought he wouldn't make it through last year, but he's still here. I went to visit Sean at his home in Raleigh, North Carolina. It was the night before he was to meet one of his daughters for the first time.
I cannot wait. I honestly know I'm going to have trouble sleeping tonight.
Sean always wanted to marry and have kids. That didn't happen, but he did donate sperm at a fertility clinic at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, when he was a student there in the late 80s and early 90s. His daughters, he recently learned about, are half-sisters, and they'd been hoping for years to find him, the man who gave them half of their DNA.
I'm wondering, what do you wear when you go to meet your biological dad?
26-year-old Nicole Elsie, or Nikki, is packing her bag at her home in Eureka, California. She's on her way to meet Sean.
What do you wear when you have been looking for someone for 16 years and it's finally happening? And I'm excited and I'm a bundle of nerves and, so happy.
Nikki's half-sister, Kelly Best, lives in North Carolina, just an hour from Sean. They've already met a few times.
When I found Sean, it felt like this big gaping hole inside of me could finally be filled and closed because I had a lot of love to give this person that I knew existed. And it was like radiating out of me with nowhere to go, just bouncing off the walls of the inside of my heart.
It's just incredible. I have a new family. And how great is that?
The next morning at the airport, Nikki's flight has landed. Sean walks up as close as he can to the passenger walkway. His parents are right behind him. He says he thinks life has a way of giving you just what you need.
I think that might be her.
At exactly the right time.
That's her. Yes. Woohoo. Come here, you.
How are you?
Great to see you.
I can't believe I'm here.
This is fantastic. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
In between hugs, it becomes clear the pictures and FaceTime calls didn't lie. Sean and Nikki look like father and daughter. And as Sean's dad points out, Nikki bears a strong resemblance to Sean's mom, Marion.
My God, Marion, you guys look just alike.
Especially
with, you know, your glasses on.
She's good looking, isn't she?
Oh, thank you. I got good jeans.
When Sean decided almost 30 years ago to become a sperm donor, he didn't take it lightly. He says he saw it as a way to make a difference for people who were struggling to have kids.
If there are things where I'm in a good spot to help somebody do this, well, then I'd be stupid not to try and help.
And that's Sean, always doing things for others, like organizing fundraisers or other efforts to help someone with cancer. Then, in September of 2015, Sean himself was diagnosed with brain cancer, the worst form of brain cancer. Doctors at Duke said it was one of the biggest glioblastomas they had ever seen. They did a 10-hour surgery to remove what they could, started radiation and chemotherapy, and then predicted Sean would live about 6 months or maybe a year. That was almost 20 months ago.
It is so nice to see you.
It's good to be here.
How are you holding up?
Back at Sean's apartment, his other newly discovered daughter, 24-year-old Kelly Best, arrives. She looks like Sean, too, with dark hair, big eyes, and a round face. This visit is part family reunion, part family history lesson, part therapy session. Sean's parents and Kelly's mom are here. There are tears and lots of laughter. And there's lots of talk about how Kelly and Nikki found each other a few years ago. They were each registered on various ancestry and donor sibling websites. Kelly had had a bunch of DNA tests done. Then Nikki got her DNA tested. She was stunned when she received an email saying her DNA had matched with about 900 people.
I realized that I could sort by percent shared of genetic information, and it immediately refreshed with Kelly Best as my half-sibling. It popped up and said, half-sister. And I was like, oh, look at that. I have a... What?
Once the sisters connected with each other, the race to find their biological father picked up steam. The sisters say they weren't looking for a father. They love their dads. But Nikki and Kelly wanted to know where they came from. They wanted the sperm donor to know who they were. Early this year, Kelly found out her DNA had matched with the closest cousin yet. She made contact with him, and suddenly the family tree she had been drawing up led to Sean Bunn. A quick Google search revealed Sean was sick. Hundreds of friends and loved ones were now raising money to help him.
I always looked with a sense of urgency when I looked, because I could picture the donor in a hospital bed somewhere. And I was like, what if I stop looking and he dies the next month? Or what if I stop looking too soon? And then that was actually the situation. And that was the most painful part, because there was all of this joy of, I finally found him, and he's dying.
And when you hear him say something like, I think this is why I'm still here, what does that make you think and feel when you hear that?
It's heart-wrenching.
Again, Sean's other biological daughter, Nikki Elsie.
I'm so happy that he feels that way, and it really is a beautiful thing. And I'm so happy that he's still here.
Of all the things on the radar screen, this was not even a bleep.
For Sean's mom, Marion, what was on the radar screen were MRIs, chemotherapy infusions, and a dizzying array of medications for her son, helping him navigate his new world, not being able to read or drive or always speak clearly because of the damage done to his brain. Tough times, but there was also constant amazement that for the last year, every brain scan Sean underwent showed the remaining visible tumor was shrinking. And then for Marion, the news, she had two granddaughters.
You never hesitated to welcome them into your family and your lives.
No way. They're our family.
They're part of Sean.
You have that same outpouring of love that you never knew you were capable of, but it's there, and you just, it's just such an experience.
A paternity test has since confirmed to 99.997% certainty that Sean is Kelly's father and thereby Nikki's.
If life would have given me a bad break and cancer had gotten me before, I would have missed this, and that would have been just horrible. It would have been crushing. I'm so happy that at the end of the day, we can say, how lucky were we to deal with this at the right time.
Glioblastoma is not believed to be hereditary in most cases. Sean's father, Ben Bunn, tells Kelly and Nikki they've given Sean new purpose.
Watching him come back to life for a father
who's thought about the possibility that my son may not be around. He may predecease me. That's been huge for me. And so I just want to thank you guys for letting us share the lives that you have and tell you how much new life and new energy and new happiness and new joy that all that has brought to us.
I just stand in awe at the miracle that we're all able to be in the same room together right now and be like this little hodgepodge family.
Kelly and Nikki have pointed out to Sean and his parents that that family could grow. There could be more biological children out there as a result of Sean's sperm donations. His parents say they'd welcome that news. More grandchildren, more pieces of their son to carry on. Sean's most recent brain MRIs have come up neat. That means no evidence of active tumor. Incredible news for a glioblastoma patient. He says if any more biological children find him, he has plenty more love to give for as long as he's able. For Here and Now, I'm Lynn Joliker.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Sunbasket. Sunbasket makes it easy to cook nutritionist-approved meals in your own kitchen with organic, non-GMO ingredients from farms and fishermen sent directly to your door. Choose from paleo, gluten-free, vegetarian, breakfast, and family options. You'll get pre-measured ingredients and easy-to-follow directions and get dinner on the table in 30 minutes. It's healthy cooking designed to fit your busy lifestyle, and it's delicious. Here and Now listeners get their first three meals free at sunbasket.com/now.
Amazon announced today that it is buying Whole Foods Market for nearly $14 billion. It's the biggest deal yet for the e-commerce giant, which has been pushing further into the grocery business. And it comes as Whole Foods stock has lost nearly half of its value since 2013. Michael Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so big news in this purchase here. Whole Foods co-founder and CEO John Mackey, though, is going to stay on. So tell us more.
Well, as you said, the gist of this deal is basically that the stock has been beaten down pretty badly in recent years. And when that happens, there are what are known as activist shareholders that start buying the stock and loudly agitating for changes. In this case, it was a well-known activist hedge fund called JANA Partners. And it's sort of a surprise, this deal, because the Whole Foods CEO, John Mackey, just a few days ago had criticized them, calling them, quote, greedy bastards looking to make a quick buck by having Whole Foods sold. So it sounded like he was going to dig in his heels and fight them, but he ended up selling. And one interesting thing, like you said, he remains as CEO. So it's arguably a win-win for him and for the activist shareholders.
Well, and maybe some Whole Foods shoppers might think it's a win for them. I mean, could we be getting organic kale or $11 jars of peanut butter delivered via Amazon drones?
You can get the kale, Magna. My drone's going to be delivering maybe some bacon and Kraft brews. But you're absolutely right. The imaginations are flying now about how transformative this could be to the industry. Yeah, the grocery business has gotten very competitive in large part because there's almost an arms race in technology to make the supply chains more efficient. And Amazon is certainly the biggest revolutionary force in the supply chain. The market reaction has been fascinating. Some rival grocery chains are down like 10%. Shares of Walmart, Target sold off. Even a bunch of European grocery chains sold off on the news. So it's being interpreted by the market place as a very, very much a game changer in the industry.
I mean, just think of the sort of penetration that Amazon has with Whole Foods now, because, you know, it can directly link you and your kitchen, you know, through Echo, I guess, to Whole Foods. I mean, are we looking at a future where one could just, you know, say, I need a gallon of milk and it just gets delivered?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, I think we're almost there already. You know, and Amazon has had its own Amazon Fresh grocery business that didn't really catch on too strongly. But as part of that business, for years, they've been researching how people shop for groceries, how to, you know, make that supply chain the most efficient it can be. So this deal really allows them to quickly leverage that research and ramp up that business. And it's causing all sorts of speculation about how Amazon could use these stores as delivery hubs, whether with the drones or eventually self-driving cars for same-day fulfillment of everything Amazon sells.
Wow. And the last couple seconds we have, though, I mean, we talked about Whole Foods stock being down, but the company has also announced some store closures this year, right?
Right. You know, they've had a rough stretch. There's been a lot of competition in the organic grocery business from all sorts of chains, just as Whole Foods was undertaking a very aggressive expansion strategy. So this deal is coming at the perfect time for them.
Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And it's been 4 years since the brothers Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev stunned the country and attacked the Boston Marathon with pressure cooker bombs. Since the marathon bombing, we've reported on a number of other attacks in Paris, Manchester, Brussels, where the attackers either used bombs that, like the ones in Boston, were packed full of nails, or where the attackers were brothers, where patterns seem to be emerging. So what have we learned from the marathon bombing? Well, Meghna Chakrabarty has been looking into that. When Meghna's not with us on Here and Now, she hosts a program at WBUR called Radio Boston. And Meghna, full disclosure, as many listeners know, I knew one of the bombers, the younger brother, through a young relative. And we'll always have questions about how did this happen. But you and producer Jamie Bologna spent months digging into this, and you tell us you still have more questions than answers.
Exactly, Robin. And that's why we wanted to spend months trying to find answers to some of these questions, because it's been 4 years and we still don't know about critical things about what the government knew about Tamerlan and Jahar Tsarnaev before the bombing, relationships they may had, questions about Tamerlan's immigration file. And then there's the broader question about whether other folks were involved in the bombing.
Well, let's start there. People might be surprised to hear that one of the biggest unresolved questions that you really reminded us of is, who built these bombs? In one of the pretrial motions before Jahar's trial, the prosecutors filed a motion pretty clearly indicating it's unlikely the Tsarnaevs built those bombs.
Right. I mean, again, this is the government before Jahar Tsarnaev's trial saying they didn't find enough black powder in the Tsarnaevs' home or in their cars or on them to indicate that they built the bombs. So they said officially there may be other bomb makers out there. And this was a couple of years ago when they said that. So this is the first unanswered question that we really wanted to tackle. We, just a little earlier this year, asked the current acting U.S. attorney, William Weinreb, who was the prosecutor in the Tsarnaev terrorism trial, whether or not the government feels like it has captured the bomb makers. And here's what he said.
The Boston Marathon bombing case was one of the most thoroughly investigated cases that I have ever come across. Despite all of that investigation, I think it is fair to say that there are still a number of questions unanswered about that case. Maybe the answers will emerge over time.
So here you have a U.S. attorney saying, basically, we don't know, and we couldn't get a straight answer about whether or not there's an active investigation to find out who made the bombs.
Well, and so that means potentially that there is someone else still maybe in this region, or at least in the country, that is laying low and might be capable of doing this. Another of the major questions has to do with the older brother, Tamerlan Tsarnaev. To remind people, he was killed in the shootout that followed the bombing when the two brothers were on the run. Questions about whether he was an FBI informant. Now, this sounds like, there are a lot of conspiracy theories, too, so you have to kind of tease them apart. But talk about this question.
Yeah, so this was a question that, a lot of conspiracy theorists have raised. But it was also officially raised in October, just a couple of months after the marathon bombing, by Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley. He sent a letter to the FBI saying, was Tamerlan Tsarnaev a federal informant? Didn't get an answer. But then again, in Jahar Tsarnaev's terrorism trial, his defense team put into the official record the claim that the brother, the older brother, was an FBI informant. So we really wanted to see if we could get to the bottom of this. But Robin, this is one of the recurring themes in this special project that my producer and I undertook. There's a deep amount of resistance amongst people who know or the federal government to provide any clarifying information. So, we couldn't get to the bottom of it, but we learned a lot about the federal informant program as a whole, which raise even more questions as well.
And we want to hear what you learned about the informant program, because people may be asking, well, why would Tamerlan Tsarnaev be an informant in the first place? We want to remember that he and his family came as refugees to the United States from Chechnya years ago when they were children. And then he traveled back. Before he traveled back to Chechnya, he was questioned by U.S. authorities. Some people feel there might have been some sort of trade-off. Explain what the informant program is, what you found.
Yeah, so let me first of all just state that the FBI repeatedly has denied that Tamara Tsarnaev was ever an informant. They've had a denial about it since 2013, and they continued to do that. They sent us the same 2013 statement saying that the Tsarnaevs were never approached by the FBI to be informants. That's what the FBI claims. But we do know overall that the informant program is massive. There could be upwards of 15,000 informants currently working for the FBI, maybe more than 18,000 working for the Drug Enforcement Agency. And Robin, here's the thing. I mean, there have been cases in which terrorist attacks have had informants involved in them. I mean, one of the most spectacular ones was the 2008 Mumbai terrorist attack, whose mastermind was an American, a Pakistani-American named David Headley, who was a DEA informant. Mm. And so we didn't find out about his involvement there, of course, until after the attacks and his federal terrorism trial. So there are a lot of areas in which many people believe that there should be more sunshine put on the informant program.
Right. And again, the FBI is denying Tamara Tsarnaev was in that program. But why does it matter whether or not he was?
Yeah, so here's the thing. It's a really good question. It matters because the informant program is growing. The informant program, a lot of law enforcement officials tell us, is essential. They can't do their jobs to protect national security without having people in communities where there may be some concern. But on the other hand, after 9/11, virtually all of law enforcement and federal informant programs focused on counterterrorism, which means that Muslims in America, and specifically Muslim immigrants, have been targeted or recruited or sought after to be federal informants. And that can be problematic. So just listen to what Michael German has to say. He spoke to us. He's a former FBI agent, spent 16 years doing counterterrorism undercover. And here's what he said.
Informants are the bread and butter of law enforcement. But because the entire Muslim community was viewed as suspect, basically any Muslim that the government had some leverage over could be coerced into becoming an informant.
And flesh that out. What does he mean? What leverage does law enforcement have over immigrants, particularly Muslim immigrants?
Yeah, so leverage in this case means they're applying to become a citizen, or they're applying to for their green cards, or they're interacting with the government in any way regarding their immigration status. And it turns out that the FBI actually has training documents that they give that they use to train new special agents, where they say, you know, you should know about your potential informant's, quote unquote, immigration vulnerabilities, and that's a place where you can say, hey, you know, we might be able to help you get your green card if you become an informant for us. And this all comes under the auspices of a really big program that was started in 2008 by the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS. It's called CARP, the Controlled Application Review and Resolution Program. And really the key thing about it here, Robin, is that this is actually an official program that lets law enforcement have a say over immigration applications for anyone who's trying to become a U.S. citizen. And that has an effect, Robin. Just listen to Susan Church. She's the former chair of the New England chapter of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And here's what she said about the special treatment that immigrants who are in the CARP program get.
There are specific officers that are deemed CARP officers, and they get the file before a person is even interviewed by immigration.
And more importantly, that special CARP officer interacts with law enforcement to see whether or not there are issues with the immigration application.
Well, this is where to bring us back to Tamara Tsarnaev, the older brother, the Boston bomber who was killed, who we said his family came here as refugees. He wanted to get U.S. citizenship. He tried to get U.S. citizenship in 2012.
That's right. And so we looked at his immigration file closely. And Robin, in it, we found evidence that his immigration file was routed through this CARP program, again, which raises questions about, you know, at that moment, was that one of those leverage points that the government may have had over Tsarnaev? We don't know because they wouldn't answer any of our questions about this. Robin, look, obviously there are a lot of questions here and not enough answers. But the point is that, you know, lots of law enforcement officials, former law enforcement officials, and even some Congress people have been saying, we need more accountability. And accountability isn't mutually exclusive to the good work that so many law enforcement folks and informants are doing. They're not in conflict with each other. And there's a problem if we don't have that kind of accountability. I mean, just listen to, again, Michael German. He's the former FBI agent. He spent almost 20 years undercover doing this work. And here's why he says more sunshine is going to help us all.
Instead of doing a full accounting for what happened, there's a knee-jerk reaction to shut the lid on it, but that causes more problems than it solves and just ensures that we're going to have future catastrophes like this that could have been prevented.
Former FBI agent Michael German, Meghna Chakrabarty took that deep dive into what have we learned from the Boston Marathon bombings. We'll have more at hereandnow.org of her reporting. Meghna, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin. One of the TV shows grabbing headlines in the last few weeks is Hulu's latest, The Handmaid's Tale, adapted from a 1985 book by Margaret Atwood. It's set in a futuristic dystopia where some women, called handmaids, are forced to bear children for men of the ruling class. Here's the series' main character, Offred, describing life as a handmaid.
A chair, a table, a lamp. There's a window with white curtains. And the glass is shatterproof, but it isn't running away they're afraid of. The handmaid wouldn't get far.
Hulu released the season finale of the show on Wednesday. Here with more is NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
Well, first of all, Eric, give us some perspective. I mean, has this show been a success for Hulu?
Well, that's the interesting thing about these streaming services. They never tell you how many people watch the show. But what we can say is this show has had a tremendous sort of pop culture impact. A lot of people are talking about it. Elizabeth Moss has been on the cover of a lot of magazines. There's been a lot of buzz about the show. And it seems to have crystallized what Hulu is trying to do in its original scripted programming in the way that House of Cards and Orange is the New Black was sort of signature shows for Netflix, and the way that Transparent is a signature show for Amazon. And it's also expected to do well when the Emmy nominations come out. Mm. And if that does happen, then that's some outward sort of independent sign that the show is really caught fire with people.
All right, well, let's listen to another clip from the show. This is a scene where captured women are being indoctrinated as handmaids.
Fertility is a gift directly from God. He left you intact for a biblical purpose. Like Bila served Rachel, you girls will serve the leaders of the faithful and their barren wives. You will bear children for them.
So that takes us straight to the heart of why this is a dystopian tale, right? And people are making connections, as you said earlier, between the story in A Handmaid's Tale and what a lot of people feel today's political world is like.
Well, and just for people who may not be familiar with the story, basically this takes place in sort of an alternate contemporary time where a far right-wing theocracy has taken over America in a war. And because of nuclear waste and pollution, most women in the country are infertile. And women have been stripped of their rights. They're not allowed to have bank accounts or jobs. They're supposed to be completely subservient to men. They're not allowed to read books or write them. And in the middle of all of this, they find that a select number of women remain fertile. And so those women are forced into sexual slavery. They're forced to have sex with the leaders of the country and have babies with them. And so what you really get is this vision of slavery, but it's visited on contemporary, mostly white women. And I think that's what sort of distinguishes this show. They've done a great job of building out this world and making it feel authentic and real, but the reason why it's a horror show is that it takes all of the techniques that were used to enslave people of color hundreds of years ago, and it brings them into the modern age and uses them to oppress a mostly white, you know, when you see The Handmaids, they're mostly white.
Well, so let me ask you about that, because that is one of the lines of criticism about the show, that it glosses over what was some pretty significant racial commentary in Margaret Atwood's original novel. I mean, how does the show treat characters and people of color?
Well, I don't know that Margaret Atwood had a lot of racial commentary. Basically, in the book, the theocracy is racist, and it's taken all the people of color and shipped them off somewhere. So that's how the book explains that they're mm-hmm. not part of the story. What people have said is that they've corrected one thing in that they've included people of color in the story. So a best friend of Elizabeth Moss's character, who knew her before all of this, is played by Samira Wiley, a woman from Orange is the New Black, a woman of color. And there are people of color that you see in the background, and there's a significant scene where a Mexican contingent, an ambassador from Mexico, comes and strikes a deal with this theocracy, and there's no sense that there's racism involved. And people have said, I think quite rightly, that it's given the struggle that we've seen in contemporary society with conservative ideology and race, it's hard to imagine that a theocracy could take over America and there wouldn't be some vestiges of racism. And the show itself seems to push people of color to the margins in some ways and not talk about that. And I think part of it is that everything else about the world of the show is so authentic that it seems odd that they didn't deal with this element of it.
It's a pretty intense show, too. I mean, do you think it's something that people could binge watch, or should they pace themselves?
Well, you know, people have talked about that. That you know, they released, I think, two episodes when it debuted, and then they've released an episode a week. And in some ways, because it's so horrific, and because it feels like something that could happen now, maybe it helps people to get it in stages.
Yeah. Well, Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. Eric, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.